Firstly, thanks so much to you, Rachel. For hosting.
Pleasure.
Much appreciated. Everyone, I think, knows Rabbi Goodman, one way or another. Thank you very much for giving up your precious time.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Another, thank you. Promises to be another epic shift.
Don't know about that, but let's give it a go.
Just want to say, I don't know if you're planning on saying this anyway.
Go on.
But I don't know if this is should be little Nishmas or just generally,
right.
But of a big fan of Rabbi Goodman, Ronnie Cohen, who sadly was Nifta a few days ago.
Yep.
Ronnie was a, can I call him, is it fair to call him a fanatical follower of your Derech Hashem Shir?
I don't know, fanatical, he was certainly... He was
an addict of your Derech
Hashem. He was a focused student.
He was an absolute
devotee.
Someone who was a real inspirational character and a very special man. So I think it's appropriate to mention him and that hopefully his share should
be a merit for his sabbat. Or was that Yachmiel ben
Leib?
Yachmiel ben Leib. Ilu Nishmas.
That's all I've got to say for myself.
And that's it. And we're off. Under starters orders. Wow. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very, very much. Thank you very much, Family Harris, for hosting. And really very good of you. It's lovely to be here. And also thank you to Dovey Common of the Whitefield Forum for organising. I believe this is 3 of 3 now. So you've had like a 3 instalment. So you've given a shiur about ideas for the Seder, and there's also been a halachic shiur, and I've been asked tonight to go really deep. Okay, like super, like just zappy deep, like zap them. That was the idea. Now, so is that okay? So it's going to be really, really intense. Is that okay? Are you braced for this? It's not going to be like a halachic thing. It's going to be like a philosophical, kabbalistic concept, like a mind-blowing intensity. Yeah, is that what I'm for? Everyone in is it everyone? You should see around. Everyone's like dosed up on alcohol. It's like everyone's got little shots of schnapps. And okay, we're in for the long run. Okay, all right. So what I'd like to do today is share with you a very deep idea, so that you can take something practically from that in understanding not only the Haggadah but things in general. Okay, that's something we got to, I don't want to lose sight of that, because we're going to go so deep into one idea that I don't want to get loose. The whole thing is it becomes practical long-term for you. Okay? Is everyone, yeah, is that? What does the word Haggadah actually mean? That is what Haggadah means.
Story.
Nope. It's a good shot, though. A tzippur is a story, really. Hmm? Good, a recounting, that's right. If somebody goes to court and the Beis Din say, you know, what did you see Joey do on the 13th of Av in McDonald's? And he goes, well, I saw him having bacon double cheeseburger, I did. Him say, sorry, it's a very cockney thing to say. There are people like watching, like what he's talking to. If you go in and you say to someone, this is what I saw, this is what happened, that testimony or witness statement is called a Haggadah. So you often see the term Haggadah coming in saying, if someone stands up and says, you know, tell us what happened, and I recount to you a bunch of events, that is called a Haggadah. So really the Haggadah is called Haggadah Shel Pesach. It's the recounting of the witness testimony specifically of Pesach. Now it's called colloquially the Haggadah, but really a Haggadah is any recounting of any data. So if I tell you what happened at a great show and there was a wonderful comedian and stuff like that, that would be a Haggadah. I'm relating over to you a witness statement. I saw him do this, and then he blew up a balloon and it shot across the room and it, I don't know, burst into glitter. It was amazing. That's a Haggadah. That's a relate, and then court would write that down and go, that's what we saw. And that's the Haggadah of an aid. So Haggadah really means testimony or witness statement. And the Chazal, which are our Chachamim, our sages of the Anshei Knesset Gedola, the men of the Great Assembly, who compiled the Haggadah as we know it today, designed it in such a way that if you do it properly, you will feel as if you're coming out of your own personal Mitzrayim. Everyone here is in their own Mitzrayim. The word Mitzrayim literally means the straits, the physical straits. That's actually what the country is called. And if you recite the Haggadah correctly, you can also feel as if you're unfettering yourself from your own burdens and your own dogmas that you'll feel enslaved to. So much so Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch says in his introduction to the Haggadah that a Chinaman languishing in a jail somewhere in China can read the Haggadah and get some uplift. He'd be able to say, you know what, there's something in this. If he reads it correctly, he should also feel chizuk. He should also feel uplift that he's getting something practical out of the Haggadah. So far, so it's an amazing Israel. How, I don't know about you, but I mean, we've been through, how do you get that? You know what I mean? To me, it's like, you know, just run straight through to the, you know, get matzahs and stuff like that and sing Dayanu and just get on with it, you know, maybe do some dippy dippies with the fingers. But I don't exactly see how a Chinaman is going to get some kind of like amazing uplift that they're going to feel as, wow, you know, I feel the freedom. How's that going to work? So there's many different parts of the Haggadah that we could look at that talk to us. But I'm going to focus on the four sons. Okay, this is a theme in the Haggadah of the four sons. And the four sons are the Chacham, the wise son, the Rosha, the wicked son, the Tom, the simple son, just accepting everything as they go, and the She'eni Yodei Lishoel. And the kid who's sitting there doesn't even know how to ask. He's incompetent even how to ask. He's just watching proceedings. He doesn't even know what's going on. He doesn't know how to say, like, what are you doing? He just doesn't know what to do. Usually in the books, he's a cartoonist little baby with a pacifier, you know what I'm saying? But he could be older. Yeah. Now, the Maharal says as follows. These four sons not only can be seen as four different types of Jew that are actually sitting around the table, they're four different elements of our own personalities. Because every single person has an element of these four people in their psyche. Every person has someone who's wise and clever about a particular topic. They're knowledgeable about a particular area. Every single person has an element within them. The person that goes, ah, what a load of nonsense. Ah, no, well, you know, you're... Especially when it comes to, let's say, if someone's like talking about Torah mitzvahs, they feel as if it's like over the top or something like that. They feel as if it's like they're going sugar from, let's say, right? Ugh, we don't do that. They're crazy, right? That's kind of that kind of element. The Tom is, you know, I'm very laid back with anything. Whatever you put in front of me, I'm willing to go for it. Okay, you know, very laid back. It doesn't bother me. And the She'eni Yodei Lishoel is the kind of element of our psyche which simply doesn't know anything about a particular topic. We're so open, you were like an open book, and we don't even know like what the specific language is or what the technical terms of a particular thing. I don't know, like metalwork or something like that. Let's say you don't know about it, you're just watching, I don't know, a video on metalwork. And you really don't know, you're just watching it. You don't even know how to ask it. Is that a brazing on? What's a soldering on? We're just completely fresh to it. Does that make sense? So what have we got with these four sons? Each one of the four sons... you're just looking at a light. There we go. Should we do that? There we go. We're back. Here's a very exciting piano moment there. Each one of the four sons is an element of our own psyche, of our own mind, of our own intelligence, of our own das. What we're going to do is look, we're going to home in on one of these sons and try to understand a very, very deep idea as to how we can grow in our own personal lives with a message straight out of the Haggadah. So far, so any questions up until this point? Oh, you guys are completely with this. It's fantastic.
All chachamim.
I want to say like this. Let's have a look at the Rosha. I always like, you always sink your teeth into a good villain. You know, if you get a good role, always sink your teeth into someone who's really, really, you know, really impassioned and angry. It's just very exciting. So the Rosha Mahu Oimer, we have this part of the Haggadah that says, the wicked one, what does he say? What is the purpose of this service to you? Now notice, if you cross-reference with the Chacham, if you look at what the wise one said, the Chacham said, what are all the laws and decrees that Hashem has commanded us? We're a team, we got mitzvahs to do, how do we do the mitzvahs? I don't know how to do the mitzvahs, I want to do the mitzvahs, can you tell me how to do it? The Rosh is asking almost an identical question. He's saying, what is all this? Which is what the Chacham's saying. But then he says, to you, I'm not involved. You're wasting your time. You're just wasting your time doing all this. You could be out at the football, you go to the ballet, there's a wonderful opera going on, you could have caught the opera, it's first night Pesach, okay, so put that to the side. You're wasting your time. You're sitting there around a table and you've got flatbreads and they're not very tasty, and what are you doing? That's what he's saying. I.e., I know you're doing it, but why, what are you getting out of this? But he's asking a very, very similar question, what are you doing, to the Chacham? But his emphasis is, why are you doing it and why I'm not part of it? I'm not part of it. I want to know why you're doing it. Well, the Chochem is part of it. He's involved and he wants to get involved. He just doesn't know how to do it, so he's asking specifics. Very interesting. What does the Haggadah come around and say? Because he removed himself, min haklal, from the community who's keeping the mitzvahs, we call him a kofa ba'ikah. He's literally uprooted the basic principle of Judaism of being together and doing the mitzvahs together. Good evening, right? So what do we do? Va'af ata haka es shinov. What do? We have to blunt his teeth. I don't know if you got the text message about what the title of tonight's lecture is. And that's blunting teeth and an ethos. What's this blunting of teeth? Says the Haggadah, you know what we're going to do to this Rosh? You know what we tell him? We tell him that it's because of this. We blunt his teeth and say, it's because of this, and usually hold up the matzah at that point, because of these mitzvahs that Hashem's done and the things that I'm going to do, that's why he took me out of Egypt. But he says it's for me and not for him. And then we say an amazing thing. Had he have been there, he'd never have got out. Had he have been there in that particular environment, he never would have made it out of Egypt. Now, who is that statement actually addressing? Imagine we're around the table and imagine some guy turns around in this blank seat here and says, you're wasting your time. You could go to the football tonight. The football is a fantastic game on. And let's say I'm the balustrade and I say, had he have been there, he wouldn't have got out. Who am I talking to?
Which one of the sons you do.
No, who am I talking to now? If I give that answer to someone that's asking me that question, who am I addressing?
Everyone else.
Everyone else around the table, not the Russia. I'm not talking to him. If you notice what he says, we say, had he have been there, that's third person, he would not have been redeemed. That means I'm talking to you about him when he's asking a question. He's saying, what is all this to you? And I turn around and go, had he had been there, he wouldn't have got out. Isn't that an interesting answer? Why don't you turn around to him and go, listen, let's talk about it. Let's talk about you. I'm not engaging him. Can you see what's going on? Does that make sense? Is that yeah, comfortable? No? Yeah. Okay, well, let me just go over that again. Let's try this one more time. It's good. Let's go over one more time. There's four children who are all asking questions. And we've got, even an individual, by the way, who is by themselves, has to recite the Haggadah and has to go through this. And the Rosha is the person that turns around and says, what are you doing round this table doing this, wasting your time? And the Balaseda, the answer that we read out from the Haggadah is, had that person have been there with that kind of attitude, they wouldn't have come out with us out from the Exodus from Egypt. So the question is, why don't we address him? Why are we addressing everybody else? So the answer is like this. When you hear statements that attack faith in public, it's everyone else around the table that's initially affected. He's sounding off about a particular statement. Mm. And everyone's thinking, God, why are we doing all this? And immediately the Baal Seder says the Rishonim. You okay?
Just checking you were working.
Oh, am I here? Hi, so you can see me there? Yeah. Yeah, it's all good. Are we good?
Yeah, we're good.
We're there. Excellent. So the Balasada turns around and says, had he have been there, he wouldn't have got out. He's reaffirming and re-solidifying the other people's faith around the table. That's the first thing he's got to do. So he's got to say, listen, with an attitude like that, you are not going to get out of Egypt. However, what's really deep about this are the words Haka Eshinov. We're going to blunt his teeth. Well, just take those. I would take those words completely out the Haggadah. Obviously, they're written with tremendous wisdom and depth, and we have to try to understand them. But I think they're wasting ink. And just turn around and say, it's because of these mitzvahs, that's why Hashem took me out. And had he had been there, he wouldn't have made it out. Not had you had been there, you hadn't have made it out. I'm not addressing you. Had he had been there, he wouldn't have made it out. So I saw Malbim, an amazing Malbim, I want to share with you. And he says like this. When you say, if I'm going to blunt someone's tooth, how would I go about doing that? Yeah. What a strange. They don't say punch his teeth out. They don't say punch him in the face. They don't say kick him in the stomach. They don't say sweep his legs. They say blunt his teeth. So what is blunting of teeth? Blunting of teeth is actually a self-inflicted injury. If you blunt your own teeth, you've ground your own teeth down. I can't grind your teeth down. You grind your teeth down. Is it called bruxism or something like that? When they give you a brace or something, if you like grind your teeth. Mm. There's like a medical condition, you know what I mean? That's grinding of teeth. It's not something I can do to you.
Is that so you can't talk? If you do that, you can't talk.
I think some people, while they're sleeping, they kind of grind their teeth and their teeth go flat. Mm. It's like a problem, right? I don't know, is that called bruxism or something?
Yeah.
So, but I can't do that to you. I can't do that to you. I'm not going to. What am I doing to do? Open your mouth around the seder table. This would be a really interesting seder. You probably didn't give that as a top tip around your seder. Open the bag, get a file, and just. Are we going to blunt your teeth? That'd be a crazy thing to do. So why do we say? What do you mean blunting his teeth? We're telling him about blunting his teeth that it's his own lifestyle. What's causing him this distress is self-inflicted. Blunting of teeth is a self-inflicted injury. Your question coming out about what's going on, about what's happening here, isn't a fact that what we're doing is wrong. It's the fact that you don't understand it because you haven't researched and you don't know what's going on. Mm. So you're turning around and you're going, gosh, what are you all doing? Blunt his teeth and say, excuse me, we've got mitzvahs to do and you're not looking at the mitzvahs. So that's just a basic introduction to this concept of blunting the teeth, yeah? Have you ever wondered why humans have two sets of teeth and not more?
Baby teeth
and adult teeth. Sharks constantly grow teeth. I think that would make a lot of evolutionary sense, actually. Because as you grow, you would need them. If you break them, just grow another one. They have like a conveyor belt of teeth. They're always growing. And if you break one off, you don't need to worry about it. You kind of like have them always coming out during your lifetime. And it was older people wouldn't need dentures and things like that.
So why don't we have?
Why do we have two Dufka sets of teeth? Yeah, yeah. Dentures. All right. So I have here a handout. I'm just going to flash this to the screen. The handout's like this. I want to share with you a piece of Kabbalah from the Zohar Kodesh and the Kit Bayari. Okay, which is from the Arizal, which is Rabbi Yitzhak Luria HaAshkenazi, who is the fountainhead of Kabbalistic wisdom in Sfas, in the Middle Ages. And he has a very, very interesting idea. And he learns out everything from the Hebrew letters and their structure as to how things work. So I want to show you one of these things about teeth. Is that okay? It's going to be really exciting. It's really unusual anyway. We're not going to hear this very often. You see this? Can everyone see this picture? It is a Hebrew letter, chof. Can you see that? Yeah? Nothing up my sleeves. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Pick a letter, put it back in the back, juggle it. Yeah, is that correct? Yeah. Now he says like this. The chof represents a mouth. And he says it's anatomically correct. And we'll go through it like this. The top of the chof over here is the hard palate, which is the bottom of a bone called the maxillae, I think. Yeah, the maxillae is this bone over here, correct? Oh, yeah, I'm just asking, looking around, maxillae. Yeah, dentists here, any dentists?
No,
okay. And the bottom of this chof is the jaw that's at rest. That's this bone here called the mandible. Now, if you ever have a puppet, if you don't do puppets, any puppet, and people do puppets for the kids, good round the table. I've got puppets this year, it's very good. I've got a puppet and a pharaoh hat, it's very good. So anyway, I've got a pharaoh hat, it's very nice. I'll take it back afterwards. When you do a puppet, it's actually not anatomically correct, because usually when you do hand puppets like this, you move the top of the hand. But when people talk, they don't talk like this. That'd be really cute, though. Like a Sesame Street is. We don't do that. The bit that moves is only the mandible, right? So it opens up like this. So you've got this kind of temporomandibular joint there, the TMJ that opens up, and it twists, and the jaw opens, and that's how we talk. Notice that the letter chof has two forms. Has a form when it's in the middle of a word or the front of a word. And it has a form when it's at the end of a word called a final chof or an endachof. Yeah, look at that. Isn't that good? Yep. Notice which part opens. It's the jaw which opens. So it opens and closes as it talks, and that's the letter chof. So far, so good. Is everyone with it? How's this? Is this working so far? I'm easy. I don't know what I'm going to do that, but okay. Well, okay. We'll build it up as we go. It's not the end. Does this make sense? So far, so good. Okay. It says like this. It says that Ari reveals a deep secret. It says like this. we know that the first letter of Hashem's name is Yud. And he Kabbalistically says that the letter Yud is always synonymous with wisdom. There's a lot to go into that. Now, I could go into that. I'm not going to go into that. I'm just going to accept that as read at the moment, then we may come back and revisit that. But Yud is the letter of Chochmah. Yud is the letter of wisdom. It's a very interesting idea. Let me show you another letter. And that's a letter Fei. You see that? Now, can you see the letter Fei? Oh, that's a letter Fei. For all those joining us in internet land. Did I not show the Chochmah? There's the Chochmah. Okay, here's the letter Fei. Now, if you have a look, the letter Fei looks basically identical to a Chof. But it's got an upside-down suspended Yud coming in from the top that's hanging inside the Chof. Can you see that? So it's basically a Fei and a Chof are written pretty much identically, except if you turn this upside down, I guess you can kind of see there's a Yud there, right? I mean, upside down. Can you see there's like a Yud hanging down there? So that Yud is called a tooth. And that tooth is coming into the gap of the Chof. That's actually how you draw it. So with a quill, you draw an upside down Yud and suspend the tooth in the mouth. And the Fei also opens like a Chof, like a mouth. What is the Hebrew word for mouth? Peh, which is the letter Peh, which is the letter Pei. Pei means mouth. And the letter Pei is a mouth. The letter Pei is a mouth like a Chof, except it's got a tooth in. Because mouths tend to have teeth in them. Does that get, yeah? So that's the actual shape of the letter Fei. Can you see that? Does that make sense? Yeah, everybody there? Yeah, loads of Fei, Chof, yeah. Same thing there. Is this making sense, yeah? Is it wisdom? Oh, so the Yud is the tooth of wisdom. We'll talk about what this means. Wisdom. He's jumping ahead there. The Yud is the tooth of wisdom coming into the mouth, coming into the oral cavity. So far, so good? All right, we'll come back to that in a second. Which teeth develop first?
The baby teeth.
Yeah, okay, of the baby teeth, which teeth develop first? Yeah, if we can turn the phones off, that aren't needed yet. The front teeth. And then what? So using my teeth. And then what? You can look at your own teeth in internet land.
Backwards.
Right. What's the next teeth? It's the canines. Yeah. The pointy ones, they're like the vampire ones, right? And then the last teeth to develop are the molars. So Alpi Kabbalah, you've got to hear, this is mummish. I think this is really, really amazing. He says like this, what the incisors, these front teeth, when you smile, you see these flat, big kind of square teeth. What do they do physically? They grasp onto food. The first thing an incisor does is it's like a nipper, like a plier or something that holds onto something. The canines, these pointy ones, like they tear into meat. That's what they do, they're sharp, right? And what the molars do, they grind against each other and pulverize. And as the food moves deeper into your mouth, that you kind of like get each tooth doing its job. So you hold onto it, then you rip it apart, and then nom, 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 nom. It's what we do. And then all the food goes in. Yeah, is that good? We're just talking about how we eat. Yeah, this was a how to eat session. So, right. Okay, there is more to it, people. All right. So let's think about that now, Kabbalistically, coming back to what the Ari says. The Ari says like this, the incisors are the teeth which are a physical manifestation of the part of the mind which is developing, which can grab onto ideas. So when you have a part of the mind that develops onto something, you can grab onto an idea, it makes an incisor. The more you develop, the older you get, you get the next teeth around, which are the canines, and that allows you to tear into a complex thought because it allows you to rip something apart, which was harder. Finally, as you get more mental development, the tooth that comes down from above, notice what's above the palate is the brain. The brain would sit above here, wouldn't it? In an anatomical thing. What's coming down into the mouth is the molar. That's an ability to pulverize and grind and thoroughly, logically think through an idea very deeply. Notice also the molars are deeper into the mouth. You have to bring the food and the idea deeper into you to be able to grind it up that much. So those are the three types of teeth which are available. So much so, Alpi Kabbalah, you can look at a child's teeth and know what parts of his mentality are developing by what parts of teeth are actually coming through into his mouth. It's a whole Kabbalah to do with teeth. Amazing concept. Why do we have two sets of teeth? Looking the Kabbalah for the answer. It's like this. If the teeth are an expression of one's wisdom, of one's mentality coming into physical realm, into the mouth, which is part of this Kabbalistic concept, we have two such mentalities in our lives only. We have childhood, we have adulthood. And it's two ways in our lives of seeing things. With our childhood, it makes one set of teeth as an outcrop of one way of looking at things. Then we lose that. Notice we shed those teeth. It'd be interesting to keep those teeth and then grow another set. So we have kind of two layers of teeth. But we don't. We lose all of those teeth and grow new teeth. That's because we lose the way of seeing the world as a child, and we can now only see the world as an adult.
But you lose them very early.
You can lose.
You're an adult.
That's correct, because you already start developing.
Well, you're at 7 or
12. Well, already at 12, a girl is considered fully mature. Even as you're losing the teeth, what we're saying is as the mind is developing, at 12, I mean, my kids still have some wobbly teeth at about 10, 11. The idea is that the teeth are coming out when your mind is maturing. And according to Tyra, one is responsible for oneself at 12 or 13, which I don't think is very, very young. But already as we can see, the teeth are starting to pop through. This is a development of maturity, which is happening quite early on. In fact, very early, even like a baby, when they start getting their little front teeth there, already their mind is developing enough to start grasping ideas. That's why you can look at each particular tooth and associate a particular mental process which is developing with each tooth. It's a very interesting concept. Okay.
Something that I was learning, because I was asking someone about what age should a kid being, but obviously from any age, but apparently from 5, that's when they should really understand, learning about Pesach.
Right, between 5 and 9, we usually say between 5 and 9. I think it also depends on the child. If a child is really advanced and they're very into it, then obviously do it younger. Yeah. But we say around about 9, by that time, they certainly should be getting involved. Yeah, we say about 9 is the age of chinuch. It depends also, in different cities, in different countries, it would go based upon what the children there are able and capable to do. That's about right. Between 5 and 9, we start to get them really involved because they can start to understand the concepts. That's right. It's interesting, of course, that as we get older and we get wiser, we develop more mentality. And what happens to our teeth? We get more teeth that come out when we're a bit older. And what do the Gentiles call those teeth?
Wisdom
teeth. Have you noticed? Wisdom. Why do they call it wisdom teeth? They're onto something. A wisdom tooth is a tooth which comes later when you've developed even more wisdom. And notice they're the ones deepest into your mouth. They're the ones that can grind at a further level of ability of thought. They can. Yeah, they can do. They can cause a lot of problems. Yes,
you won't. So
when you have them removed, you lose all your wisdom.
Not that you know, you don't lose the wisdom with the teeth, but they're coming out because of that. Yeah. Very good. Why do old people start shedding their teeth at the end of their lives? Their mind starts breaking down too, and that's why the teeth are shed. It's exactly correct. But the point is that is not such an uncommon concept. That's exactly correct. So we see that there is a link between teeth and mental acuity, stimulus acuity and things like that. And the Gentiles also refer to these additional teeth as wisdom teeth. So we learn now, all that whole Kabbalistic concept with the Fey and the Chof and the Fey, all that business, all of that is actually to explain the fact that teeth have something to do with the mental way that you're seeing things. You've got mental faculties and the teeth are attached to that. So what's going on? We're told that we're told to blunt the Rosh's teeth. We have to flatten his teeth out. That's a very codified message. And this is, we had to do all that background data with the teeth and the Kabbalah and the letters to understand this point as to what it means to break his teeth. It's a very interesting idea. One of the things that we're told is that we say when the Rosh, had he have been in Mitzrayim, had he been there, he wouldn't have got out. He wouldn't have got out. Now, did you know that most of the Jews did not get out of Egypt? Most of the Jews didn't leave. What fraction of the Jews made it out?
10%. Less than two.
One fifth. Was that 80%? Is it 20%? It's 80% died, 20% came out. Only 20%, one fifth of the Jews made it out. And four fifths of the, what happened to those, the other four fifths? What happened to them?
You just said they died.
They died when? Oh, I said it already. Okay.
No, did they die?
Yeah, they died. And what, do you know when did they die? In the plague of darkness. In the plague of darkness. So the Egyptians shouldn't see the Jews suffering, so that that would give them respite to think, oh, we're affected by the plagues, and they're affected by the plagues too, and there's no difference between us and them. They couldn't see what was going on. They were locked in darkness. And the Jews at that time, during that whole week that was really dark, they were burying their brethren. And of course, there was lots and lots of children that were left over from all those families, and they adopted all of those children. So usually every family took on approximately five children. When they left Egypt, they had five adopted children, as well as their own children as well. And that was considered a great merit for them, doing that tremendous chesed.
Rabbi, when we talk 20%, are we only talking about the men? Or is that including the women?
It's global. It's global. It's 20% of Jews survived that Golas Mitzrayim. Four-fifths died of all Jewry in Egypt at that time.
We count them in those days.
Yeah,
well, the men.
Yeah, you're right. We counted the men at Mount Sinai, which is 603,550 between the ages of 20 and 60. That's true. We counted them going in as well. We knew how many families there were, etc. I can go into the actual specific numbers. The Maral has a whole thing to do with the numbers, but we know four-fifths died because the Torah reports they came out chomashim, they came out armed, and that also means they came out with fifths because the Medrash says four-fifths died. So they had to take out five kids, as it were, on top of each family to absorb the children who did not die. The children did not die. Why did the four-fifths die? Because they were so assimilated into the Egyptian culture that had God have given them the Torah, they would have only seen it through secular eyes. How's that? Are we good there? There we go. They'd only seen it through, there we go. Yeah, good. They'd only seen it through secular eyes. So therefore God didn't want to give them the Torah, because they were basically too Egyptian. They'd lost their connection to their roots. So had they've got the Torah, it wouldn't have worked for them. Yeah.
Wouldn't the Egyptians have noticed that, a load of people had died?
That's a very, you mean at Marcus? Yeah. So after, you've got to remember that after the plague of darkness, they were busy. The Jews had also gone into the houses and found out where their valuables were. And the next thing that happened after the plague of darkness, well, God actually says, can you please ask your neighbour for all those nice trinkets? And the neighbour would say, no, I don't have any. Because actually you do, it's under the third drawer in your closet, you're hiding it under a pile of clothing. Oh, that one, yeah, right. So they were busy giving them that stuff. Also remember, the Jews did not live with the Gentiles at the time. They had their own area where they were segregated into a ghetto. So whether, I think if you look into Nazi Germany and stuff like that, and saw ghettos, I don't know, maybe dropping or dwindling in numbers, I don't know if the local Gentiles, because it was behind walls and stuff like that, knew that there was a population census. I'm not sure how much they interacted with them. Remember, they wouldn't even eat with them. Even when Yosef's family came in to eat, he said, everyone's got to be sitting at another table because we ate meat, and they wouldn't eat meat because they worshipped those animals. So it's considered taboo. So there was always quite a bit of segregation.
Who decided that they? I mean, did God decide that these people would not be appropriate, suitable, or did they choose not to go?
No,
they
was,
say we don't believe.
There was no. Yeah, in the plague of the firstborn.
Yeah.
There was a test. If you daub your doorposts with the blood of the Paschal Lamb.
Right.
Then at midnight, when I go through the town, I will skip over Pesach. I will jump over your house and I'll protect you. Anyone that doesn't do that, I'm going in, I'm going to kill the firstborn. With the plague of darkness, there was no such test. God himself organized a derivation between which Jews were going to be okay for the next plague and which Jews weren't.
So they lost the firstborn.
Well, most of the Jews didn't. By the one-fifth that was left were pretty devoted. So the vast majority of those didn't lose the firstborn.
For the 80%?
No, they were already gone by that time. They didn't make it to plague number 10. The plague number 9 was before plague number 10. So plague number 10 was the last one, and that was the death of the firstborn. Plague number 9 was darkness, and that was just prior.
Could they be if they were segregated? And
very good. So Rashi, a very good question. Rashi says that, I'll tell you an amazing story. There's a story. There was a rabbi friend of mine called Rabbi Shlomo Simon, who is a shadchan. He's a matchmaker in Jerusalem. And he was traveling, I'm not sure if it was Mexico or Sao Paulo, or Mexico City or Sao Paulo. It's one of those two. And he was with a taxi driver and was going around town. And he said, are there any Jews in the city? He goes, are there any Jews? This city is mainly Jews. So my son said, really? Nobody told me. He goes, there must be millions in this city alone. So he said, I'm not sure that's actually street. He goes, yes, says the taxi driver. I see them everywhere. So he's driving down the road and there's like Goldberg solicitors and there's like Friedman accountants and there's like this and there's all these names of companies and they're all Jews. Says the Torah that Egypt felt as if the Jews were crawling all around. They were like literally swarming. The term the Torah uses is swarming in Egypt. The truth was, if you look at the numbers though, it doesn't add up. It doesn't add up. So what does it mean? It means wherever Jews are, because they rise up to influence and do lots in their host culture, the host culture generally thinks there's more of them than there really are. Do you know what percentage of the British population Jews are? At the moment, it's standing at 0.2%. 0.2%. That is, I would like to say, from anyone who does statistics, you could wipe that out statistically as insignificant. If you get a 0.2 error margin, you could say it's not there. So technically, we're not even there. From a mathematical perspective, 0.2% is like an error that you get sometimes, and like a stat. We don't exist. And yet, if you were to ask, right, well, we're busy with levers. Well, this is it now. And we have levers, and we will take over the world. We're not. We're
poison those people in
the we're not. We're not doing. There's hardly any of us. But if you were to ask a regular English person in the room, how many Jews do you think there are in England? I doubt they'd say, oh well, they must be only a fraction of 1%. No. They won't say that. That's bomb, but that's exactly true. By the way, what percentage, according to the census that was done in 2011, what percentage of that 0.2% is Orthodox? Strictly Orthodox, according to the census rules, not according to our rules. 10% of 0.2% are recognisable immediately as Orthodox Jews. 10%. Of 0.2%. Is that 0.02%? 0.0. We're talking about. Basically, if I think in the regular census, I think in 2011, they said there's 260,000 Jews in the UK. 260,000 Jews. That's how many people answered to say they were Jewish. 260,000. That could have been a guy who was Muslim just ticking the Jewish box as a joke. Or someone that felt as if he was a Jedi and he missed. Do you know what I mean? So if there's 260,000 Jews and you only got 10% of that, we're looking, what, at around 30,000 Orthodox Jews in the entire United Kingdom, max. But I think if you were to ask a Gentile how many Orthodox Jews are there, they'd say more than... That's like, you've got to understand, that's one side of Wembley Stadium. That's a corner of Wembley Stadium. And that's everyone in the whole country. That's what it means, that the Egyptians felt as if the Jews were everywhere. It says their theatres and their circuses were full of Jews. The secular Jews loved going there. And when they went to their theatres, their cinemas and their things, like that, they saw Jews everywhere. And they felt as if they're invading our culture. And they didn't like it. But the truth was, on an actual numbers terms, it's not true. That's an interesting thing that seems to be, I guess, happening today as well, no? It's a very interesting concept. How do we get to that? Oh, because we got off about Rabbi Shlomo Simon and driving around. And you talked about assimilation and we talked about Rabbi Simon. Okay, I've got, all right, I'm back. Everyone back, come with me. We're back, let's go. Okay. So, we talked about blunting teeth, right? About blunting teeth, what's going on? I said like these. Oh, when you want to deal with a Russia, in your own mind, remember we've all got a Russia living in here as well, all of us. How do you deal with him? You blunt his teeth. Now, if I'm going to blunt your teeth, I'm not going to smash your teeth, I'm not going to extract your teeth, I'm going to file them down. when God teaches us how to deal with our own internal Russia and someone external, it's a slow, grinding process. The Russia in the Egypt story is Pharaoh. He's a real Russia. I mean, he really was a real. Do you know what he used to do for his skin condition?
Yes.
He had a skin condition, so the doctors told him there's a treatment available.
Baby's blood.
You need to bathe in Jewish baby's blood. And he did that on a regular basis. Now, that's a lot of babies you have to kill, because there's not a lot of blood in each baby. There's this big Russia who's got a bath full of Jewish baby's blood, and he's washing himself like that. And Hashem wants to deal with him. Now, what I would do is I'd do this. There you go. And that's it. And I just kill every single Egyptian and just, like, you know, just sound a trumpet or something. All the Jews get up and go. All the Egyptians just died in one mass plague. That's what I'd have done. But notice what God does. He gently and slowly grinds them down. He grinds them down, layer by layer. There's the most amazing Ma'am Loez that explains the Egyptians believe that the world was governed in their mind by 10 spheres. I never heard about this before, saw the Ma'am Loez. I was fascinated to learn about it. But today we have, like, scientific principles, which, by the way, are being eaten away in our own generation by quantum mechanics. There's things that we're learning about in modern quantum that does not fit with all the rules that we've got in modern science. It is turning science upside down. In our own lifetime, we're seeing that. Now, there's been different scientific views of the world for a long time, and I'm going to read out to you what the Egyptians believed. They believed that they were spheres that needed worshipping, and they had churches and temples for each one of these 10 different spheres, and their laws were immutable. And here are the ten, and I'm going to go through each one very slowly, just little bit by little, and explain how each of the plagues link with them. They believed, number one, the first god they needed to worship was the moon, then Mercury, then Venus, then the sun, then Mars. Don't know why that goes above the sun. Then Jupiter, then Saturn, and then all the stars of the zodiac. Then what they called the outer sphere, which I guess maybe is the edge of the universe. And then the highest sphere that had the most power for them was the sphere of the mind, the sphere of the intellect. And they would worship and offer gods and sacrifice animals to these gods. That's how they lived, okay? Look, if you want to live in Egypt, that's how it was. You know, you go to different countries and they have, it's Hindu people have cows and, I don't know, everyone's got a different thing going, you know what I mean? That's how they did it.
They knew about all those planets then?
Yes, amazingly, they knew Saturn had rings. That's because we know they had telescopes. Indeed, Yosef had a telescope with him. And when Benjamin, his brother, came in to see Tzfas Paneach, the viceroy, who he didn't know was his brother, he said to Benjamin, "Are you any good at star reading?" And he goes, "Yes, my family's excellent," because Avram Avinu was a master astrologer. She says, "Really? Show me what's going." So he says, "By the way, aren't you missing someone in your family?" He goes, "Yes, we got a brother, but he's lost." She says, "Why don't you try find him for me?" He goes, "Okay, if you give me a telescope, I'll figure it out." So it says, the Medrash says, Benjamin took out a sheet and he split up the sky into quadrants and he looked with a telescope and he mapped out all the stars. Took him about an hour. The Medrash says, took him about an hour. Then he turned around and said, "According to this chart, it is my brother standing next to me." Yosef revealed himself privately to Benjamin and said, "Don't tell anyone, you're absolutely right, it's me." He says, what? What have you been doing? And he goes, all this came from astrology. They also knew Sirius was a binary star. They also had the concepts that are possibly a concept of black holes that we understand the black holes today. They understood. Remember, the pyramids that they have are built in a way that is absolutely extraordinary. There's a whole shear that you could give just about the bit. Also, the things in the pyramids, you have red granite from South America, and Pharaoh and all the pharaohs have traces of cocaine in the embalming fluid. Cocaine is indigenous to South America. It's fascinating that both Pharaoh in North Africa and the Mayan culture and the Aztecs in South America both built pyramids at the same time using same technology. And apparently there's trade between them. One of the city of the dead in the Mayan pyramids is a scale ratio of the Milky Way. NASA only recently figured that out in the 1980s. How did they get the ratios? The three pyramids, the three big pyramids in Giza, they are a direct ratio of the three stars in the belt of Orion. Now what's amazing, you know, there's a smaller one, a bigger one, and a bigger one. The three stars in Orion are actually far away from the Earth. they're not all an actual line of stars. One's millions of miles away, one's not so far away, and one's closer. The exact ratio of which is closer to the Earth is shown in the exact height of the pyramids. And that's why when the zodiac went round, there were windows in the pyramid, and different stars aligned in the windows, and the pharaoh believed that his soul would be shot out through to the stars through that particular window. And that's why at solstice, certain to the North Star and things like that line up on windows that are inside the pyramids that are there only to allow the... You know Stonehenge, they have this thing, the solstice, the sun stones, the sun is right above one of the stones. It's the same thing in the pyramids, that there'd be an alignment of stars. They had very high-level technology. It's amazing, amazing stuff. I've got a whole... Does that answer that question? There's lots to research there. So let's just very quickly, sir. So what did God want to do? We're going to blunt the teeth of the Russia, right? So these Egyptians, notice, God is waiting for you to call the shots and he'll follow you. Whatever you do, he'll go according to what you say. He doesn't do what you do. He's waiting for you to make a choice. Then once you've made your choice, he'll respond to you in kind. So what did they believe was the first God they had to worship? The moon. What did they believe about the moon? That it was in control of water. Now that kind of fits, because it's in control of the tides, right? When the moon goes, the gravity pulls the water and it causes tides, yeah? Yeah, is that so far? That makes sense, yeah? So what did God do? He attacked the water and turned it to blood. So they went, oh, bring a cow, let us slaughter to the god of the moon. Moon. I don't know how this is going to come through on that. So they're running towards me. So Rabbi running towards me, slaughtering a cow. So it's like this. So he's doing that. And did it work? Didn't work at all. Gosh, now, that's very interesting. How come our god of the moon wasn't able to fix the water? Oh, well, must have been his day off. I believe in my science. Must have been his day off. Okay, fine. Who's the next god? The god of Mercury. What's Mercury in charge of? They believed Mercury influences creatures that live in the water. So what did God do? Sent the frogs, which are amphibious. So they went and slaughtered to the god of Mercury, and it didn't work. Venus. Venus influences beauty in the world. That's what the Egyptians believed. I don't think that's pretty far from the Greeks as well. The Greeks also thought that, no? God is a louse. Venus, right? Beauty and love, all that business. What's the most detestable thing you can think of? It's a louse. The earth, all the dust in the world became lice. It's the most detestable, it's the least beautiful thing in the world. So they slaughtered to the god of Venus, going, come on, help us out here. Didn't work out. They believe that the sun influences desert animals. The plague of wild beasts caused such animals to leave the habitat and go into Egyptian houses. Didn't work for them. They kept... Okay. Mars, they thought, influences blood and body warmth. Opposing it came pestilence, where the animals lost their body heat and died. The Rambam says there was a very hard chill in the air, which caused the animals like a flu and they died. Jupiter was supposed to balance out body fluids, preventing one from becoming too wet or too dry. So then the boils came, and we learn out the boils were wet on the inside and dry on the outside. So whatever medicine they were put on, let's say you got wet boils and you put on one particular medicine, that would get a problem with the dry part of the boil. And if you put on a moisturizer, that would ruin it because it's wet on the inside, so they had no medicine. So we see that the wet and the dry just completely blew their mind about the fact that Jupiter didn't work. The Egyptians believed that the gods dedicated to Saturn could influence anything to do with ice, snow, or cold. God sent the hail, which was mixed with fire. It's just impossible. So they went to say, Saturn can't do that. Then the stars of the zodiac is next. And they thought that influenced all living creatures. And they used to pray on a regular basis to the zodiac to keep locusts out their boundaries. Because that was a real problem. And along came the locusts, and they prayed to the zodiac, it couldn't work. Finally, there was the outer sphere, which according to their belief was responsible for the progression of day and night. God made the plague of darkness. 3 days just jet black, 3 days plus 3 days just blur black. And the last one, the ultimate one, was the sphere of intellect. And they believed that the firstborn had a special advantage because they were directly linked to the intellect. And for that, some kind of spirituality came into the world. And they actually used to make their priests into the firstborn. The firstborn were the priests. Isn't it interesting? We were meant to do that as well. And then we lost that at the golden calf. And the Kohanim weren't the firstborn, but the firstborn are also meant to be the priests in Judaism. So what did God do? Came along and killed the firstborn. Why is he doing it like this? because he wants to teach them a lesson as you go. Notice when the third plague of lice came over, the Pharaoh's advisors said, it's the finger of God. God's getting involved. And Pharaoh was stubborn. He didn't care. But they were saying, it's God. It's not us. We can't do this. We can't replicate this. They're telling Pharaoh, don't be an idiot. Egypt is lost. Already at number 3 out of 10. Now, he should have listened to them. But he said, no, okay. How do you have stopped at blood and go, whoa, 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 whoa. Hold on. If it doesn't work with the moon, F shit won't work with anything else at all. Let's stop and listen to this Moses fellow. Maybe he's onto something. But he didn't. So because he needed more and more medicine, more and more medicine came. God was peeling away the layers as it went. He peeled away the layers. When we list out in the Haggadah all of the plagues, do you have a minhag to take out with your finger? A bit of wine. Sephardim pour out and they dump the wine in the garden and stuff like this. Got a whole thing, terrified of that wine. What we shouldn't do is lick the finger. In order to be able to take on that concept that at the end of the day, we're taking out wine, that our joy should be limited because we're not happy that anyone has to suffer. If they have to go through hard medical procedures to learn what reality is, the fact that it's amazing that God did it, it's a diminution of my joy as well. I don't want to be so happy when someone has to be sad. Whoever that, even if they're wicked Nazis, it doesn't matter who they are. I don't want anyone to be upset. So therefore, I limit my joy by taking some of the wine out. And wine is a symbol of joy on that night. So we go, do you do it on a napkin? So for day, right? And then the Haggadah says what I think is possibly the most ridiculous thing in the entire Haggadah. Rebbe Yehuda, one of the greatest minds ever, says, oh, Rebbe Yehuda Hanoisen Behem Simonu, he made up a mnemonic. And we do it again. Datsach Adash Ba'achav. And what did he do? He just took the first letters of each of them and he made a simon. So the Dalet he put there, that's a D, like a Tsa, a Tzadi, Tsa. And then the Kinim, the Ka, he makes one word, Datsach. And then he just takes the first letter, like an acrostic, and makes like a mnemonic to remember all of them by taking the first letter. Oh, hold on here. I get a kid of like 6 today. I don't need one of the greatest rabbis who's ever lived to go and put, it's okay, I'll make it. Do you know what I mean? With respect, I can do it. We'll highlight the D for you. Okay, it's fine. I don't need. What is going on? I've got to show you the most amazing metric. Pharaoh used to go to and do his business in the morning in the Nile because he thought he was a god, but actually,
wasn't the Nile considered part
of yes, God? But he felt as if he was nourishing the Nile with his body fluids, right. And the Nile needed him to give him the body fluid so it could be prosperous because he was a god above the Nile. Right. So God told Moses, when he's out there, you go early in the morning. And you turn up and you speak to Pharaoh while he's at the bank of the Nile. So Pharaoh, who's this like really big guy, he turned up in the morning like with a roll of loo paper, whatever it was. And there's Moses standing there going, morning, aren't you a god? Well, that just haven't clocked on yet. It's at 9:30, you know what I mean? Like still Pharaoh the man at the moment. And God said to him, take the staff with you in your hand and turn up. Why did he have to take the staff with him every time? I've made myself a toy staff this year for my son, by the way, with a springy snake inside. So I intend to like do that and then pull it out. I'm quite excited. It's my first attempt. I got a toy like a snake that scares birds. It looks very realistic. I'm going to go, you'll see if he likes it. That's a little bit of a side thing there. Yeah, it's actually a different son. I'll never make that up. Yeah, okay, that's an in-joke. Okay, so, all right, so what's going on here? Yeah, because I did one of my son's bris, and I didn't do that. I mulled one of my son. Don't worry. I had to bring it up, didn't you? Bring it up, couldn't let it lie. Couldn't just let that one slide. Where was I? All right, so he says, I want you to take the staff with you. Says the Medrash Rabbah, an unbelievable thing. The letters of Datsach Adash Ba'achav were engraved on that staff before he ever went down to Egypt the first time. And he's standing there, but can I just have those cups, Leon? No, those ones, yeah, that's great. So imagine he's standing there with a staff, and it has the letters on it of Datsach Adash Ba'achav. And he's standing like this, going, morning, Pharaoh. Look, you know I came to you about this whole, like, letting the Jews go, I'm going to have to ask you again. I want the Jews to go. And he goes, no, 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 no. Remember this? Why has he got to be there with these letters? This is the most unbelievable argument. Unbelievable, there's two opinions. I've got it there, so I've got to share it with you. This is such a deep idea. Says Rabbi Aaron Kotler, why were those letters on the staff? The letters Datzach Adash Ba'achav were written in heaven, that there's no way that Pharaoh's going to get away with it, and these letters are going to already be written before Moses goes to Egypt. But they're just letters. We've just done Sefer De'akinim, right? We've just read out that one is D for Dalad, Sefer De'it Sadi, Kinim is Ch. And so those letters come in. It's like this. Those letters were written in heaven. They didn't have to be those plagues. It's down to your choice. He takes the staff to Pharaoh and said, these letters are coming your way, whatever happens. But what you do with those letters is what you choose. If you choose to let the Jews go or not be so rude, instead of the Dalad coming out as Dom, instead of the D coming out as blood, it'll come out as something else, less severe, or even a blessing for you. These letters are coming to you no matter what. But how you express the lesson I'm trying to teach you about blunting of your teeth with all these gods, that's down to you and your own life. God doesn't force us into a corner in our lives. He allows us to do whatever we choose to do. If we choose to learn, if we choose to become more developed in the community, if we choose to be together and have achdus, all kinds of blessings open up. If we choose to do the opposite, sometimes we can get a shake. But though whatever it is, we'll have the same letter. What's written on Rosh Hashanah can't be changed. What can be changed is how it's delivered. You can get £100,000, put it in the bank. It's coming your way. Or you could lose it all in a fine. You got the other pounds, went straight to the HMRC. Comes in, depends how you want to deal with it. This is the key of the concept of the Rosha. When we deal with the Rosha inside ourselves, don't think you can just immediately take out any negative attitude to God in your brain, pull it out and throw it in the bin. God didn't do that with Pharaoh. He worked over a whole year, you know the plagues lasted, a whole year to gently erode their belief system. Notice when the Jews came out of Egypt, it said they emptied Egypt, they gutted Egypt financially, resource-wise, but also immuno-wise, belief-wise, belief system-wise, scientifically. They had nothing left because everything they believed in was gone. God had destroyed their way of seeing the world. Because they believed in the moon and Mercury and Jupiter, and now they didn't. Because they realised it doesn't work.
And Pharaoh,
he left. He didn't even go back home because there's nothing to go back home to. He went to Nineveh, became king of Nineveh. He said, forget this for a game of soldiers. And all of his soldiers died in the sea, and he just trotted off to Nineveh in Assyria. He became king of Assyria. So there was nothing left in Egypt. What do you mean there's nothing left? There's no belief left there. How did God do that? Gently, as it were, and slowly, over the period of a year, rather than just squishing them as I would have done, in one instant, kill all the Egyptians and finish, let all the Jews go. What was that teaching us? What do we learn out? When you want to work at something, it takes time. You want to understand something which you didn't understand, it takes time. Slowly, layer by layer, you've got to grind it away. And two is, with these letters on the staff, it's totally dependent upon your choices. Whatever you want to do is how God will relate to you. If you want to do something great, he'll relate to you great. If you want to distance yourself from him, he'll distance himself from you. Whatever you want to do, it's completely in your hands. That's why these letters, when we say Datzach Adash Ba'achav, are telling us it came out as blood and frogs and vermin and wild beasts and pestilence. But he didn't have to. That was his choice because he made all the worst possible choices. They came out the worst possible way. So too in our lives, if you want to approach spirituality, make better choices. It comes to you in a better way. It's an amazing concept.
So you say the Dalit could have been something else.
That's correct.
But would it have had to be something beginning?
Yes, it had to begin with a Dalit.
Have we got any theories?
I have no idea. Look, I mean, the word for dal can mean impoverished, but it can also mean incredibly blessed financially as well. So it could be that he got a blessing or a less severe plague. But the way that he was extremely rude when Moses turned around to him and said, the God of the Jews wants to go. First of all, I don't know this God. Second of all, I'm certainly not letting my Jews go. Third of all, he wants to, that he can go to war with me. Like anyone else. I'm a God, he's a God, we can go to fight. That's a really rude thing to say. That's really, really rude. But that's exactly what he said. The Or Chaim says that's exactly what he said. He was like, listen, you know, first of all, I don't know his UK Vavka name, and other names. And second of all, I don't think he's even real anymore. I thought after Abraham died, like, he's gone or something. He's gone to some other universe or something. I don't think he's busy in this world. I'm king of the world now, so if he wants them, he can fight with me.
It wasn't inevitable.
No, it was not inevitable.
The pharaohs could have paid differently.
That's it. And had he have chosen differently...
So I guess we assume that maybe that was just going to happen.
Right, it was... Now, that's the idea of having...
But it wasn't... It was his choice.
According to Rabbi Yehuda, whatever he chose to do is whatever God would respond. Look, Moses said, let the people go. Isn't that a question? It's not telling you... And what happens if he'd have said yes? He goes, okay, yeah, I actually don't want them. I don't like Jews very much, and I don't need them. You can have them. In fact, can I come with you? You know, have a vacation. I'm bored. You know, I'm tired. I'd love to have a holiday. Let's go to the desert. It'd be nice. Could you imagine? Could you imagine? That goes, you take me with you. I become Jewish. Imagine what would have happened. Egypt would have had a different... That is still... But that's what has to happen. That's written in Shemaim. How it happens? Totally down to you. All this is learned out from the Rosha. That's what it means to blunt his teeth. Layer by layer, we change the way we see things over a long period of time, and it's the decisions we make are completely down to us. How Hashem deals with us is whatever we deal with him. How we see things takes time to change. We blunt the teeth slowly but surely. And with that, I hope that we've got an idea as to how to take a theory from the Haggadah through the year. You can say, look, I'm angry about this point, I don't understand this, I understand. Okay, but Vakasha, that's great, that's fantastic. In the meantime, you have to work at it layer by layer. And however you work at it, it's however God will respond to you, because it's totally down to you. You're in charge, and God is waiting in the wings, as it were, for your decisions. He holds back in this world. You're in charge. What you do is how he responds to you. That's what power he's given us. And that's the power of Pharaoh. He can openly defy God, and God goes, okay, fine, you're going to defy Vakasha. Why don't you just kill him? Why don't you just kill him right there? How could you be so frontageous? Would any king put up with that? That's because he loves Pharaoh. By the way, you know when the Egyptians were drowning in the sea, the angels wanted to sing Shira. They wanted to sing a song to praise Hashem. Kadosh Baruch Hu shut them up and said, silence, I'm killing my children. I love my children. That's the Medrash Rabbah. Because I love my children. How can you sing to me? How can you sing to me when my children are being killed? I love them. The Menachem said, these are the people that killed your children. He goes, yeah, but I love them too. I don't want to hear your singing to me now. So they said, well, how can you let Israel sing? Israel is singing a song at the sea. He goes, yeah, I did a miracle for them. They owe me. By the way, if you have a car crash or something like that, and a miracle is done for you, you have a miraculous recovery, you owe God a song. Because whenever a miracle is done for you in your life, you owe him a song. You need to say thank you. We learn that out from Israel. I had a miracle done from them. The miracle at the sea is probably the Red Sea pedestrians. It's the greatest miracle they ever have, kind of thing. And we had to sing Shir. We had to say thank you so much, Hashem, for getting us out of that shtuk. We were really in trouble right there. Right, but we had to do it because we had an obligation. But he didn't want to hear from the angels because he was hurting his own children, the Egyptians. He loved the Egyptians. If only they'd come back to him. Problem was, they made bad mistakes. Pharaoh was really, really, really arrogant. Okay, you have to pay the price. Notice Pharaoh actually was the one that didn't die. He survived. How would you forgive Pharaoh, who bathed in Jewish babies' blood? God can do that.
He did.
It's unbelievable. Oh, I can't understand. It's beyond me. But we learn this out. It doesn't matter where you're at, whatever your mental process or difficulties are, you can always work through them layer by layer. And it's totally down to you. God will help you, but he waits for you to make the first move. And that's what we learn out about blunting the teeth of the Rosha. That's all coming out from the concept of teeth. This tooth suspended in the mouth. I wanted to thank you very, very much for this opportunity. And I hope you have a really wonderful, happy, uplifting and stimulating Pesach. Not only now, but you carry the concepts of Pesach with you through the year. Be'ez Hashem, as you develop through the Sfira, which is a continuation of Pesach, indeed Shavuot is meant to be on the end of Pesach, we need some time to develop to that, then we can think. Okay, it carries with us the whole year all the way through to Shavuot. So Pesach doesn't just end at the end of Pesach. The concepts run through all the way to Shavuos. So I look forward to seeing maybe again for Shavuos, where we can have another discussion. And I want to thank you very, very much for this opportunity to be able to speak here. I wish you a wonderful Chag Kosher Sameach.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
I know this is a very conceptual point.
There we go. Yeah, go on. But oh, yeah, I wouldn't mind some fizzy water or something.
Midrash or Gemara that says that the reason why Hashem allowed Pharaoh to leave
thank you.
Was to do with the fact that he took away his free will and made him harden.
There's two separate things. He allowed him to live. In fact, he says to Pharaoh, Moses says to Pharaoh at the seventh plague, God said to Pharaoh through Moses, saying, I could have killed you in the first plague, But I didn't, because he says in the Torah, I wanted to keep you alive so you could understand my ways. That's number one. He keeps you alive to understand what he's doing. Number two, whether or not he had free will is a massive discussion in the early commentators. Some say he didn't have free will and he had to be punished for his wicked acts. And that's because if someone kills someone else, which they have free will to do, it's only right they go to jail or they're punished or they're executed, because that's the law of the land and it's against their will. Alternatively, it's like this. Let's say guy's being tortured. Remember Guy Fawkes? I don't know if Guy Fawkes did it or he didn't do it, but if you put a guy on a rack and you tell him that he's converted the moon into green cheese, he'll admit, I did it, I'll sign whatever you want. Once you torture an individual, really a confession is kind of meaningless. Notice that's why the Torah constantly says, I'm going to harden the heart of Pharaoh. What does that mean technically? If a guy's on the rack, he's going through a plague and he's having a hard time. So did you want to kill, did you want to put a cake of gunpowder underneath the king's throne? And he goes, yeah. That doesn't mean anything. If you give him a dose of heroin and it completely numbs his pain and he's back to normal, even though he's on the rack, and you say, Guy, did you want to kill the king? He said, yeah. Now you can believe him. Because Pharaoh is under such pressure politically, nationally, and under the advice to give up the Jews, and physically, him and his people are suffering at the hands of these plagues. He didn't really have free will to say he wanted to keep the Jews, because if he wanted to let the Jews go, it wouldn't really be fair, would it? It's not his free will anymore. He's being forced into the situation. So God hardened his heart so that he made a free will choice. Nonetheless, God said like this, do you really want to let him go, Pharaoh? His name was Akhenaten, according to many sources. Akhenaten the second. Do you really want to let him go, Aki? So the answer's like this. Oh, I'm going to see the boils, they're horrible, they're itchy, scratchy. Hold on. Suddenly he felt great. Now, Pharaoh, now you're in a good state, yeah? Yeah, I'm actually good, actually. You don't care about the people all suffering? No, I'm good. I'm good in myself. What do you want to do? No, I don't want to let them go. Okay, on with the next plague. So even though he's overrun with agony because of the plagues, because his heart has been hardened, that doesn't mean he's going to lose his free will. Contrary, he gains his free will despite the difficulty of the situation. God doesn't want to take away your free will because that's what you've got that's closest to him. The thing that you mimic most about God is your freedom of choice. So when he takes that away, he makes you more like an animal. He doesn't want to do that. He wants you to be as godly as you can. Make your choices. Even if I'm striking you down, I'll harden your heart. Make your own choices. And that's why he hardened the heart of Pharaoh. Yeah.
But then the dollar couldn't have been something else.
So it sure could.
What I'm saying is if there wasn't freedom of choice.
If there wasn't a hardening of the heart, there's no freedom of choice. Then it'd be correct. Which
so
is why.
So there was freedom.
So there was freedom of choice, which is why there's hardening of the heart. God had to harden the heart of Pharaoh. That doesn't mean that. That's most people understand that to mean as if he became stubborn, and therefore he didn't really have a choice. And he was going to be mean to the Jews, like Hitler was going to be. No, I'm going to harden your heart because despite the suffering you're undergoing during this year, I want you to make a completely free will decision as to what you want to do with my people. Now, what do you really want to do? See how careful God is with a confirmed Russia. This is a murderer, and he loves him and he wants him to come back. How much more so about you?
I just never understood how anyone could go through all those plagues and just not do it, not give in.
Awful.
Yeah, how could they?
That's why God had to harden the heart.
Think about history repeating itself, you know, it's so long.
Massive suffering, though, that you could. I mean, if anyone would do that to me, I would say.
Just let it take them. Take them. That's why God had to get involved, harden his heart despite the suffering. And so, because really, if I torture you and say, give me your car, did I tell you my mother-in-law lives in South Africa? I just keep talking about it. It's more of a psychological unburdening, so I can just deal with it, if you don't mind. I just use a bunch of people here just to talk about my own problems, if you don't mind. Is that okay with you? Feel good, yeah? We feel good about this, yeah? My mother-in-law lives in South Africa. She was coming out of a front door to go to a shear. And there were three black men standing there with shotguns outside of a front house. They took her car, they took her money, they even took a wedding ring. And they left her. They were lucky. Apparently, she was lucky to be alive. And of course, they
right. Well, they get, but they have advantages there.
Okay.
Don't they?
Okay. Well, hold on. So now, when three men with shotguns are standing there, and they say, "Would you like to give us your wedding ring?" I don't think that's a free will choice at that moment. I mean, I guess it is. Do you want a dime? We'll take it off your dead hand. Or do you want to just give it to us and save us the bother? Mm. That's a very tough free will choice. But if you've been given a superpower at that time where you know you have a shield that no bullets can harm you,
you'd say no.
What would you say? No, that's not an answer in that particular... What you would say is, maybe, no, I'm not going to give it to you. Or maybe I will. You still have... You're totally free will. Like any guy coming up saying, listen, I'm hungry, and I need you, and you give him a crack. It was the Chortkova Rebbe, that there was a poor man that came to the door and he didn't have any food left. And he said, I'm hungry. And he goes, so he took his wife's wedding ring. And he gave him the wedding ring. He said, go sell this and you get yourself some food. Give it to Docker. So his wife came home. And she found out, she found out what had happened. And she was furious. Goes, go back and run to him. Go tell him about the ring. So he said, I'm sorry. And he ran out and he got the guy. And he said, listen, I'm really sorry about this. But that ring, it's very valuable. Make sure you get a good price for it. It's an amazing story, right? Amazing. It really happened, that, right? Because he wanted to give. He felt as if he wanted to give. Maybe she would have said, listen, if you really need it so bad, it's just a ring of metal. Take it. It's only sentimental value. Maybe she said, nothing doing. This is my wedding ring. Things, yeah, off you go. The only real free will she would have had is if I had given her some kind of like magic force field to protect her. That's what happened with Pharaoh. A force field, a magic, unusual, nace, a miracle had to happen where God said, I'm going to make you stubborn.
But that was just Pharaoh, not the other Egyptians. Were they not kind of revolting?
That's what at the 10th plague. Yeah. At the 10th plague, they stormed and they killed all the ministers. They destroyed all of Egypt in the 10th plague, because you remember they'd had enough. They literally overcame it. But Pharaoh himself was the one that had the decision policy. That's what it means, by the way. Gadolei Hador, the giants of the generation, doesn't mean the biggest tzaddik. Means anyone with influence. We learn that out. A Rosha can be a God of Lador. So Pharaoh was a God of Lador in the fact that he had world influence. I say the Jews can't leave. All these millions of people who are my citizens are now going to suffer another plague. That's right. That's how it goes. That's exactly how it's always worked. Leaders make decisions and people pay for it. That's how it works in life. Look, I don't know. I'm not bang on with British history. I do try. But I remember this whole thing with Coventry, with Winston Churchill and the Enigma machine. And they found that they were going to bomb Coventry and he didn't protect Coventry because he didn't want the Germans to know that they'd figured out. That's just a super, hello, what about if you and your family live in Coventry? Well, there's a man somewhere in Whitehall who's making a decision and you pay for it. That's how the world runs. So Moses was one man. He turned up to Pharaoh and said, what do you want to do? And Pharaoh said, I don't want to do it. And his people paid the price. By the way, there were already people that started believing in Moses at the plague of hail. They were moving their animals indoors, saying, listen, Moses says this, we believe him. The people of Egypt were believed in Moses, yeah. But in the meantime, it's not down to them to let the Jews go. Now, if you think that they're good, though, wait until the 10th plague. When finally they let the Jews go and they actually shot them out, notice everything that happened to the Jews coming out of Egypt happens to a baby when it comes out the womb. That's why the waters had to break. It's a whole thing. And that's what them going after them at the sea is the placenta. Because the afterbirth has to come out after the baby. And it never goes back into the womb. All those soldiers died. Everything that happened at a baby's birth happened at the Jews being born out of Egypt. The womb of the Jewish people was North Africa, was Egypt. Now, when they went after them, what did they say? He said, what have we done letting the Jews go? And all the soldiers said, yeah, were we mad? Let's go after them. And they all put all their money on their horses, because they used to put money on their horses when they went into battle as a segula, as a lucky charm, like a mascot, that it makes them lucky in war. So they put their jewels on their horses. It's actually today, it's called a caparison. If you put beautiful things around a horse, it's called a caparison. So they put caparisons around their horses and they went after them. And that's when they died at the seashore, all the money washed up was what they decorated the horses with. That's the placenta coming out. That's the afterbirth of Egypt. So if you think they're all so good taking their stuff inside, they weren't so good afterwards. I've got one trick question for you. Maybe use it for the Seder. There's one plague. Every plague, the Jews made money. with the blood. They were selling fresh water to the Egyptians. They're making a bit of money. You know, they were very upset with Moses. They shouted at Moses when he turned off the plague. Because it's the first time in 210 years we've ever made our own income and you come and turn it off. He goes, what do you want from me? This guy, oh, they shouted at him. But I'm making some money here. So they were selling like, you know, like a table with 50p a glass. Get your water, fresh water, Jewish water. All these Egyptians were lining up down the street to get some water. Mamish made money. Moses came along and said, right, that's the end of that. He goes, what do you mean that's the end of my money? The Jews are making money the whole time. There was one plague where they could have lost money. What plague could the Jews have lost money? This is brilliant. This is brilliant. The plague of hail. You've got to hear this when you sell your chometz. Plague of hail is like this. Let's say he's an Egyptian, and let's say I'm a Jew. Let's pretend. And he believes that the hail's going to come by now. It's going to kill his sheep. So he's got a clever plan. He comes to me and sells me 1,000 sheep of his for 50 quid. 50 quid. If I sell you 10 Mercedes Benzes for 50 quid, wouldn't you buy it? 50 quid, yeah. 50. Don't buy Jim. 10 Fords, 50 Fords. 50 quid, there you go. I'll put down money now to buy it. I'll do it. So there goes my 50 quid. So he says like this. Now that you've bought my sheep, those sheep are your sheep. There's a Jewish sheep. I don't have to take them inside. There's too many sheep. When the hail falls, it won't land on the Jewish sheep. And I'm sorted. Now, after the plague's over, I'll come back, get my sheep, and you can keep the 50 quid. Make a bit. Yeah, isn't that a clever idea? God did not honour the agreement. And he killed the Egyptian sheep while they were still amongst the Jewish sheep. These hail balls, we said the size of footballs. So let's say there's two sheep, an Egyptian sheep and a Jewish sheep, a Jewish-owned sheep. The hail would only land on the Egyptian sheep and not one of the Jewish sheep died. And Pharaoh actually went out sending people to find out if that was the case and said not one had died. Why didn't God go with that contract? The answer was it wasn't a real sale. It wasn't a real sale. If you sell your chometz, really thinking, I'm not really going to sell my chometz. It's really mine and the whole thing's a farce. Mm. You're not selling your chometz and God doesn't go with it. You've got to, I've got stickers that we put stickers on, sold to the goy. He comes in and you know, by the way, in some communities, the rabbi has 3 or 4 goyim and he sends them around to knock on people's door to ask for the whiskey. Just to test them out. And he does it randomly every year. Rabbi Zev Leff used to do that. So he sends a goy around. Mr. Smith knocks on. That's what you got to do. He's got to be real. He does that. He does that to his community. Mr. Smith knocks on the door and says, I heard you got a 50-year-old bottle of Lagavulin here. Yeah? It's mine. Can I have it, please? He's got to get it. And he does that regularly. Every year, randomly, he picks 3 families he does that with. Why? Because you've got to have in mind the sale is a real, genuine sale. If it isn't, God doesn't honour it. Now, because this wasn't a sale, he comes back and he wants his sheep at the end, right? And I say, I'm really sorry. All your sheep are dead. Anyway, that 50 quid I gave you, can I have that 50 quid back? The Egyptian says, you can go fly. You give me my sheep, I'll give you the 50 quid. So the Jews could have lost. If they invested in non-Jewish sheep at the time, in a sale which wasn't a legalistic sale, God wouldn't honour that and they would lose their money. Amazing, hey? Mm-hmm. Amazing. Now, that means when you sell your chometz, I am mamish. This doesn't belong to me. I don't let the kids play with it. It's not mine. It's theft. You can't use it. It's theft. That's why this year we can't even eat because it's Shabbos. The 8th day is Shabbos. We can't take back our chometz earlier because doing so is theft. If you, let's say, only keep 1 day because you're from Eretz Yisrael visiting here, you can't even eat on Shabbos chometz, even though it's 8th day for you. It's like Yom Tov is gone because it's theft from the goy. And we can't make a transaction on Shabbos. Don't do work on Shabbos. So I can't go to the goy and change over the goods. It's real. It's not mine. It's not mine. If you feel as if, yes, the whole thing's a big joke, then it's not real and the chometz is in your possession. The Jews could have lost money at the plague of hail if they invested with a guy like that because it wasn't real. Interesting, hey? Yeah? Great. It's great, guys. People, it's wonderful to see you.